storm. There's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgents groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurous. He is the editor and publisher of Somalia Report, founded in 2008, which has 140 correspondents working in Somalia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Thanks, Ian.
And clearly the Kenyan authorities have 11 of these. They say they've got 11 of the terrorists who took over the Westgate Mall and killed 67 people. There are still 61 people missing, according to the Kenyan Red Cross. That's a bit odd, isn't it? Now that they've secured the building, how come they can't account for 61 people?
Well, you're going to see a lot of very strange proclamations coming out of the Kenyan police and government. You know, Africa is famous for incompetence in terms of police and reporting. I was at the site of two bombings in Uganda, and they accused me of being the terrorist because I'd been to both bombings. So they have an amazing lack of sort of common sense. The reality here is that they're keeping very mum on what actually happened in this mall, because there was a significant explosion. The roof was dropped in. They may have killed a large number of hostages in their attempts to get at the terrorists.
So what do we know then about the warnings that apparently the Kenyan press are now talking about, that the cabinet was warned that there'd be attacks between September 13th and the 20th, that the Israelis who own the mall had their own warnings as well? And you would think that, I mean, first of all, are these recriminations political, or is there some real evidence that the head of the National Intelligence Service, who will be questioned by Kenya's members of parliament on Monday, screwed up?
Well, I think it's really important to understand what happened there. This is not an al-Shabaab attack per se. There's always been a group there called the Muslim Youth Center, which Samantha Luthwaite was a part of. And it was run by Kenyans.
Let's mention her again. She is what's called the White Widow, right? She's the British woman who was married to a Jamaican fellow who was one of the suicide bombers in the July 7th suicide bombing in the London subways. And then she subsequently married a Kenyan man and ended up in Kenya involved in some of the explosions. And then Kenyan authorities questioned her, and she showed them a phony South African passport and was able to escape to Somalia.
Yeah, that's correct. She ran their website and their Twitter account under MYC Press. And this group was the organization that recruited foreigners from various countries. There's something like 80 from America, 40 from the UK, and who knows, from other countries, and get them up into Somalia where they could join al-Shabaab. And al-Shabaab used to use these foreigners only for suicide attacks. Most of the people that blow themselves up or in car bombs inside Somalia turn out to be foreign volunteers. That group is called al-Hijra, which is meaning journey. And what they would do is take these foreigners, send them up there. But what happened when they killed al-Amriki, the American from Daphne, Alabama, there was a backlash against foreigners. So this is the first time that foreigners have actually taken part in a violent attack against a major target. And if you've been to Nairobi and if you know the embassy crowd and the sort of expat journal crowd, this mall is the single largest, softest target in Nairobi. And the Art Cafe is where everybody met. And strangely enough, it's where HSM Press and MYC used to sit and do their Twitters because they had free internet. So it's kind of ironic that many of the terrorists used to actually go there and shop and eat at the mall. So everybody knew this was a very soft target. Now, in terms of the actual dates, NYC had been infiltrated because it was so easy to get foreigners in there who said they wanted to fight for al-Shabaab. So the only reason why they didn't take action is that they never really took them seriously.
So who is running NYC then, and what's the fate of the White Widow? Is she among the 11 that they're holding that they're not, the Kenyan's authorities aren't saying anything about?
Well, I don't know her fate, and I don't think anybody does. There was a backdoor escape route that was created that goes through a sewer that goes out into the river, and a large number of them probably did escape. But the NYC was essentially set up by a Muslim cleric in Nairobi, in Marengo, the poor part of town. And what happened was there began an assassination program in 2011 and 2012 where senior clerics and leaders of this group began to disappear. I mean, they were literally shot in drive-by shootings. And most people believe that was either the Israelis or the Americans. And that's what kind of turned them from a, you know, a cheerleader group and a support group for al-Shabaab into its own group. So al-Hijra is in itself its own terrorist organization.
But does it have Kenyan support? In other words, is there a diaspora of Somalians or enough?
Well, now you're getting into history, because if you look at the Swahili coast, which is Mombasa and the area that goes up and down the Indian Ocean there, that is a very old-school Muslim area of black Africans. And then if you go into the interior, you'll find that there's a lot of Christians. And there's always been a little tension between the Muslim groups along the coast, and of course they come into the cities for work, and the Christians. So that has been part of the fulcrum that they've used. If you go back in recent history, you know, the embassy bombings in bin Laden and the attack on the Israeli hotel and the attempt to shoot down an Israeli airliner, there's been a very strong anti-Israeli sentiment there because it's a very popular tourist destination, and a number of the hotels and restaurants are owned by Israeli businessmen. And, of course, the Muslims along the coast take affront to that for whatever reason and have been sort of angered by that and maybe even turned into fundamentalists because of that. So that's really the dynamics in Kenya. But typically Kenya is a very safe, normal place. There isn't a lot of, you know, demonstrations on the street or sort of anger against foreigners because they provide most of their income.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Young Pelton, who is an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspectives on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He is the editor and publisher of Somalia Report, which has been operating since 2008 with 140 correspondents in Somalia. So in terms of al-Shabaab, which came out of the Muslim League youth group, I guess, funded, I take it, by the Saudi Wahhabis, and its first thing that they did was go and sack, burn, loot, and murder the Sufis, right?
Yeah. Well, you got to be careful because al-Shabaab is a little bit of a strange bird. You know, al-Shabaab is not part of al-Qaeda as we normally know it. Al-Shabaab was, as you know, the radicalized elements of the Islamic courts that ran Somalia after the Ethiopian invasion and before. And they became a splinter group that funded themselves through kind of brutal taxation of the locals. So al-Shabaab has always supported itself by simply going to businessmen and saying, give us half your income. And they haven't really relied on outsider support that much because it's essentially an internal nationalistic movement. And it's broken into three parts. The Godani is the fellow from Hargeisa. He's an Isak tribesman. He is the most fundamental, and he is considered sort of the bad guy, but the one that aligned himself to al-Qaeda twice. Robo used to be the leader, but he's down south, and he has his loyalties amongst Baidoa and Bay Area, where al-Shabaab is fighting now. And then Dahir Always, who was sort of a cleric that led the Islamic courts, has actually defected to the government. And there was a strong pressure on Robo and Godani to split, and they began fighting amongst each other. So what you're seeing now is actually Al-Shabaab's running out of oxygen in southern Somalia, and they're looking for something to open up some type of new front. So when MYC or Al-Hijra decided to do the mall attack, that essentially shifted the war down south, because it's the Kenyans that are doing most of the fighting in the very southern part, which is called Jubaland in Somalia.
So what is the foreign component here? We've apparently, according to the FBA, at least 20 men have left Minnesota since 2007 to join Al-Shabaab. And recently there have been reports of foreigners fighting with Al-Shabaab being murdered in some kind of fratricide.
Yeah, well, obviously the number is much higher than that. They estimate it's around 80 that have left from the U.S. to volunteer and go fight. The problem is that the Somalis don't like the foreigners, and Shabaab is actually trying to cleanse itself of the foreigners, because that's what makes the locals reject it as sort of a war run by foreign mercenaries. And as you mentioned in the beginning, most of their attacks were against Sufis, and a large number of Somalis are not only not aligned with the Sunni Wahhabist principles, but they're actually very educated, worldly people who have diaspora and relatives all around the world. So Somalia is actually a very bad place for Al-Qaeda to wage a war, because the people just don't want them there. The foreigners are an extra aggravation, as you saw with Al-Amriki, or the fellow from Daphne Hamani. He actually tried to start his own little division because he felt that the Al-Shabaab was too brutal and too draconian on the locals, and he actually had a following in the south there for a while until they killed him, and Godani had him killed. And the foreigners just don't fit in. They're from Minneapolis, they're from Norway, they're from Oshawa. They're sort of soft-handed, angry little kids who go there. They have no military skills, and that's why they strapped on with a suicide vest or put in a car full of bombs and told to go drive up to a checkpoint.
So just to get some historical context on the agony of this country that's often referred to as a failed state, Robert Young Pelton, again, the editor and publisher of Somalia Report, which has operated since 2008 with 140 correspondents in Somalia. The invasion by the Ethiopians, which was a disastrous move, which was done by the Bush administration, the neocons, one of their brilliant ideas, like the invasion of Iraq, that created a big backlash because the Christian Ethiopians aren't particularly popular. My understanding is that also, in terms of foreign interference, you've got the African Union Army with 4,000 Kenyan troops coming up from the south. You've got the U.S. and the Special Forces with the drones operating in nearby Djibouti. And then you've got the Eritreans, who are secular and Marxist, nevertheless supporting the Al-Shabaab and other Islamic fundamentalists. Is that the mosaic?
Yeah, you described a very good soap opera for television. Somalia, as you probably know, is broken down by clans. So there is a government down south in Mogadishu, but each region has its own agenda. And, of course, its neighbor has its own agenda. And just to make it short and sweet, the Islamic court system actually swept in, cleaned out the warlords, very similar to the Taliban in Afghanistan, and for a brief moment set up this Wahhabist sort of caliphate in which people were quite happy and there was no crime, et cetera, et cetera. The Ethiopians came in with American support and got rid of them, and that's what created Al-Shabaab as this little sort of splinter, which means, you know, the boys or the youth, this little splinter kill thrill group. And then what happened is there was America paying Uganda to send troops under what they call Amisom to then push out Al-Shabaab in the south. The Ethiopians came in from the west, and then when they realized that they had no sort of anvil in the south, the Americans convinced the Kenyans, who had never fought a war before and had no skills, to then invade from the south. That was about 2 years ago. Well, if you live in the region, there's a place called Jubaland, which is what the British colonials set up as a buffer between the cattle-raiding Somalis and the nice, happy Kenyan pastoralists. Well, they're recreating that now around the port of Kismayo in the south, and that's what Al-Shabaab does not want, because that's their heartland. That's where they come from. That's where Robo's from. Godani's from the north, from the extreme north, which, if you look at Somaliland, it's actually its own country, and if you look at Puntland, it's not its own country, but it's separate from the southern part. Godani only has support through foreign jihadi linkages, and that's why twice he said he's linked to bin Laden and al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera. But he actually has very little support. He doesn't get tons of money from, you know, Gulf Emirates. His family lives in the UAE in Sharjah, and he constantly is getting marginalized every time he tries to get Somalis to support him because they don't want him. So he's trying Kenya now to see if that gets some kind of traction, and then he's trying to ignite the idea that, you know, Somalis really don't care, so now it's Muslim Kenyans hating against Christian Kenyans and et cetera, et cetera. So he's trying to inflame that little division down there.
Well, just in closing, now, you mentioned Puntland in the north that's on both the Indian Ocean and the Gulf of Aden. That's relatively stable. I understood there for a while an ex-CIA guy and a former Reagan administration ambassador, Pierre Prospero, were pretty much running that place like something out of Rudyard Kipling.
They weren't running it, but they set up what the UN calls the largest and best-trained military force in Somalia, in what they call the Puntland Marine Force. That's Eric Prince's project.
Eric Prince being the former head of Blackwater.
Right, and that got shut down last June. But yes, both Somaliland and Puntland are stable, and the only areas that are really sort of in chaos is Galmudug, which is in the center where the pirates used to be, and the very south where Al-Shabaab is still fighting against Amisom. But the reality is that Al-Shabaab is not anywhere else except in the very south, and they're slowly being pushed out of the south by the Kenyans, and the Ugandans have taken them out of Mogadishu. So they have to go somewhere. So I think the goal with the Kenyan raid or the attack on the Westgate Mall was to try to push the focus of the fighting into the border between Kenya and Somalia.
Well, Robert Young-Pelton, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and The War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He's the editor and publisher of Somalia Report, which has operated since 2008 with 140 correspondents in Somalia. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the former Iran specialist on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, Gary Sick, who met with the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani last Wednesday.